the situation in the Middle East is probably more complex than what we can find in any other part of the world. I think it's even more complex than the apartheid issue in South Africa. And I have called this toward an understanding, suggesting that I'm not guaranteeing that I will transmit to you a complete understanding, and I don't think anyone can understand all the aspects of it. But it'll be easier for us, I think, both to talk about it, to support our government, to pray concretely about the Middle East. And I suppose one thing that makes it so important, Russia is interested, we are interested, and what our government has worked at, and I think Russia has tried also there, is not to get a setup where there would be a compulsory confrontation of the United States and Russia, because then, somehow, accidentally or otherwise, there will be some atomic things that will happen, and if it happens on one side, it will happen on the other side. That's why this is such a terrifically difficult situation. Now, just a word about my background in understanding some of this. I say some. I visited the Near East, Mr. Schatz and I did, for the first time and spent considerable time there in 1936. And since that time, in the service of the Lutheran World Federation, I have been back 7 times. Before World War I, Germany was on very good terms with the Turkish Empire, and she got some real concessions. And there came into being 5 German mission societies that ministered to the Arabs in the old area of Palestine. And I think I could say that as far as skilled labor is concerned, masons, electricians, shoemakers, carpenters, among the Arabs, the Schneller boys, one of the orphanages was called the Syrian Orphanage, was its legal name, but was often referred to as the Schneller Orphanage. They trained orphan children, and these people that were trained in technical skills practically carried the Mideast on their backs. I mean, they were the ones who had skills, whereas others had very little. And of course, in this time, property accrued to them. Then came World War I, World War II. And of course the Germans were out completely, and some of the German missionaries had withdrawn. Even if they didn't, they had no support from the home country. The Americans came in trying to, as we did in many other parts of the world, trying to supply assistance so the work could continue on. Then came the period when Israel came into being as a nation. And of course, they took over property, and they had some of the German mission property. And as a result of the war, when it broke out, there were about 900,000 Arab refugees. Now, where I had a good deal of contact, the area of the Lutheran World Federation's work, over which I had been asked to assume responsibility and supervision, was the ministry to the refugees. And we ministered to them, the United Nations Relief Works Administration ministered to them, but we supplemented that ministry by gifts of food and gifts of clothing, and by ministry to those who were sick. A building that the Augusta Victoria Stiftung up on Mount Olives, well, it's really a little bit to the north of the Mount of Olives, was turned into a hospital. The United Nations Relief Works Administration footed the bill. The Lutheran World Federation provided the service. Then on the other side, well, first, we ministered to the refugees on a basis of need only. It didn't make any difference whether they were Christians or Mohammedans or nothing religiously. They were all ministered to on a basis of need. And this won a tremendous respect on the part of the Arabs for the LWF. And I've had experiences where I could go places where nobody else could go, but going in the name of the LWF, I could pass through. I said I had never learned so realistically what it means to come to God in the name of Jesus as it did for me to be let through Arab lines in the name of the Lutheran World Federation. The American consul on the Jerusalem side, that is on the Israeli side of Jerusalem, said to me one time, I said, I'll see you in a couple of days. Oh, he said, I don't think you'll get back. But I went through the Mandelbaum gate and I was allowed to come back, and I presented myself 2 days later, and he said to me, what are you, some kind of big shot? And I said, no, I merely went in the name of the Lutheran World Federation. Now, on the Jewish side, there was property that they had taken over, mission property. And then there was a matter of negotiating the release of this property or indemnification for it. God sent to us at that time a man by the name of Lutz, a Swiss consul who had served the Swiss government at one time in Palestine, so he was very well acquainted with everything. This man, during the time that Hitler invaded Austria, had been the Swiss consul in Austria, and there were many Jews, and he knew what would happen, and he got all the Jews together and put them in a series of buildings, apartment buildings, and then slapped the Swiss seal on each door. And Hitler's armies came and went by and didn't touch it, because Switzerland was a neutral nation and everyone has need of a neutral nation so you can make contact with the enemy in various ways. And because he did that, I have found that the Israeli people are extremely observant. They know who have been their friends and who have not. And because of what Lutz had done, they inscribed his name in the Golden Book of Jerusalem, wherein they inscribed just certain names. Winston Churchill is there, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, all those whom the Jews felt had befriended them in some way or another. And Mr. Lutz's name is there. So we had Mr. Lutz make the first approach to the government of Israel. And after he got the door open, then most of the dealing with the government fell to my lot. So that I've come to know people on both sides. I, to this day, get a Christmas card from Mr. Cadman, the administrator of justice at that time, who was the man with whom we dealt. Now, just that much to indicate that I'm not talking out of a vacuum or only opinion, but with a good deal of opportunity to have observed at close range what the climate is there. I think it's important that we keep a kind of a historical perspective, and I'm going to suggest that I want to discuss briefly five topics: the land, the people, the wars, and after that perhaps a little bit about what the church's attitude ought to be. I better follow my notes or I may get off on too much of a tangent. Just a bit about the land. When we speak of the Mideast, it's difficult to be exact about that because people use the term to describe various areas. But roughly speaking, it can be what we know as Palestine, Syria, and what we know today as Iraq and Saudi Arabia and a couple of the other Emirates, on to the Indian Ocean, from the Mediterranean on through the Indian Ocean. We don't want to go back any farther than before World War I. Then all of this area was under Turkey. When Turkey was defeated along with Germany in World War I, then the League of Nations came into being. The League of Nations adopted the attitude that colonial areas that had been under either Turkey, not many under Turkey, but that part of the land that many felt didn't belong to them. But the colonial areas of Germany should be mandated to the League of Nations, or the League of Nations would take control and they would mandate it to a given power. For example, Syria was assigned to France. Now when the League of Nations, or today the United Nations, gives a mandate to a nation over a given area, this means this nation is responsible to administer that area and try to work out a program so that they will move towards independence someday. Down in Southwest Africa, this was German West Africa before World War I. This was mandated, and South Africa has asserted its right to own and control that. That's part of what's behind the difficulty between Namibia and the upper part of German Southwest Africa. Well, now, after they got underway, Britain set up the territory she had responsibility for. She knew some of the Arab princes and leaders and sheikhs, tribal chieftains of various kinds, and she set up a government in Iraq where there was semi-independence. Likewise in Saudi Arabia, likewise in what's called Transjordan, Palestine on the eastern side of the Jordan. Then in what was thought of as Palestine, south of Syria to the Egyptian border to where the Suez Canal is, and from the Mediterranean to the Jordan. That was named Palestine. Britain took responsibility for that directly herself, and she assigned a man whom she called, whoever occupied the office, the High Commissioner. And anyone living in that area would have to deal with the High Commissioner. Now, something about, and this is about the way that the setting was as far as government up until the time of World War II. Now a little bit about the people. Many of the nationalistic Jews will talk as though the Jews had always been in the land of Palestine. For all practical purposes, one can say that's wrong. For way back in 70 AD, when Titus and his Roman army destroyed the temple, really destroyed Jerusalem, Jews fled, and they'd fled to all parts of the world. There was a remnant left. There were enough left so you could say there were Jews there, but there was no sizable group. And the Arabs who were all around moved into that area. So that, practically speaking, the Arabs have been living in Palestine for 2,000 years. Much of the land was owned by large landowners, and they would rent it out to the peasants. But even though they rented it to peasants, they would live there one generation after another. If they tilled the ground well, the owners were kind. So there developed a feeling for the land that this is ours. And any one of you know how land gets a hold of you, the place you live. And if you've lived there several generations, it really takes hold of the heartstrings. That indicates how the Arabs felt about this whole area. But despite the fact that Jews were scattered all over the world, for some reason or other, they didn't lose their love for that area of the world. Even though the Jews have been in far corners of the world, this had a tug on their heart. Let me tell you of a couple of incidents. One day when I was talking with a Jewish merchant in Jerusalem, we were wondering how we could trade the Israeli pounds, which on the open market were worth nothing, well, 35 cents, and they should have been originally worth about $2.80. And this was indemnification money, and how to get that out so that the German mission societies could use it among the Arabs, that was a problem. And it was this that came up, and I told him that I was going over to the other side through the Mandelbaum gate. Suddenly, the man who'd been talking right along stood there and he looked up in the ceiling and his eyes looked as though they were glazed, as though he were in a trance. And finally he broke this by saying, "Oh, for a chance to stand on Mount Zion." Now, he'd been born in Europe, was one who had emigrated, but he had not been on Mount Zion yet. It had a hold of him deep down. I think of one time in the spring of 36, being invited into a sort of a Jewish community house on the in the new side of Jerusalem. And a Rabbi Wilhelm from Germany was sort of the house rabbi. And they were going to observe the Feast of the Passover. We sat down at the table, and for them the usual practice is that if there are children in the group, they are catechized about the story of the Exodus, of the going out of Egypt. And it's been rare that I have seen the sparkle of interest and of knowledge that was in the eyes of these children as they eagerly raised their hands to answer the various questions. And you could sense that there in the young life of these children, already they had absorbed something of the feeling of their people for the place and for the escape from Exodus, where God had intervened on their part. This was real to them. And I think of one day when I was talking with a banker at Barker's Bank in Jerusalem, or Barclays. And while we were sitting and talking, we heard shots across the wall, and we weren't more than probably 500 feet from the wall. And I said to him, "Doesn't this bother you, sitting here? One of those shots could come through the window and get you." "Oh," he says, "no." And he said, "I feel secure." And then he said, "To be in a place where you don't feel that people are maybe not saying anything, maybe not visibly pointing, but when you walk among people, you sense somebody says, 'Ah, there's a Jew. There's a Jew.' And you get the feeling that whether you're actually ostracized or not, that you're pushed outside the pale of the rest of humanity, if you please." I had that illustrated in another way in Minneapolis when the American Lutheran Church was constituted. We were going to observe a Feast of Jubilee. When the Jews observe this, they use the ram's horn to blow in the new year or the festival. And we made up a number of those out of plastic, and they were given to each congregation as a symbol of this year of Jubilee that we were going to celebrate. And we had about 100 left over. Somebody suggested we ought to send those out to rabbis and synagogues in different parts of the countries, Orthodox, liberal, just pick them in terms of we got to spread over the country. Now, with this, I sent a mimeographed letter, didn't sign it personally, just signed the stencil. Now, that's about as impersonal a communication as you can get. And yet, I got answers back almost by return mail. And some of those rabbis almost became rhapsodical in the way they expressed themselves in their appreciation. And I said to a friend of mine, "To me, this is a window through which you may look and see and know that the Jew has felt himself as a person in the world without friends. And any show of friendship toward them is deeply appreciated." Well, now, this much about the general feeling of the peoples. About 1890, a movement called the Zionist movement came into being. With that, you associate the name of Chaim Weizmann and David Ben-Gurion, and a Jewish philosopher by the name of Gordon. And they began to agitate, and was largely among the Russian Jews to begin with, that they should return to the homeland. And they were like land firms trying to encourage people to buy land in a certain part. And quite a number of Jews began to trickle back. And all those who trickled back in the early days bought land. And by 1936, when we were there, there was a sizable group of Jews that had gone back. And this man, Gordon, the philosopher, he had preached a work ethic. Not only the Protestants have had work ethics, although Trelsch, the German philosopher and sociologist, pinned that label on the Protestants in the Protestant Reformation. But certainly there's been a work ethic as far as the Jews in returning to Palestine, to what they regarded as the promised land. You could find in the early days instances of Jews where the hillsides had been denuded, no trees. I was told that during the Turkish regime they taxed people oftentimes according to the number of trees they had. Well, if you want to reduce your taxes, you cut down the trees. But of course, then you washed away a lot of the soil, too. And I was told about one PhD degree Jew who had immigrated back, who joined with some of the other immigrants and carried in wicker baskets soil from up in the Lake Hule area, black soil, and to clothe once again the mountain and hillsides and planting trees. There was a real drive amongst these earliest people. Now, just a little bit about World War I promises in this context of the people. When World War I was being fought, Turkey was on the side of Germany. And of course, the Allies were eager to get all the help that they could. And they had, you've read about Lawrence of Arabia, who worked among the Arabs and won their confidence and won their cooperation. And then Lord Allenby, who invaded Palestine and did it with the help of a number of the Arabs. And the man who then was Ibn Saud, who was ruling, Britain had set him up in business in Saudi Arabia. He solicited and received from the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain a promise that when the war was over, for the help the Arabs had given, they would have independence and rule themselves, and Palestine would be theirs. Now remember that, because when you talk with the Jews, they'll talk as though the first promise came to them. The first promise was given to the Arabs. But not many months thereafter, suddenly there was announced a document by Great Britain, which was called Balfour's Declaration. He was then the Foreign Minister of Great Britain. And in this declaration, there was a promise that when the war was over, that Palestine was to provide a homeland for the Jews. Buried in the archives of the United Nations, you can find and the records of one of the open hearings that was held in Jerusalem, that David Ben-Gurion confessed that Balfour's declaration was actually prepared by the Zionists. And David Ben-Gurion said that they spent several days debating just how they could phrase this. And they phrased it such, they thought, so that it might be understood not as a new nation, but just as a homeland, a cultural land. But it could also, if conditions permitted, be interpreted to mean that there was to be given them a new nation, so that they would have nationhood there. When Balfour's declaration was made public, then Ibn Saud reminded Great Britain of what she had promised the Arabs. And Great Britain, through a message known as Hogarth's message, communicated with Ibn Saud and said they would not forget the promise they had given to the Arabs. Now, you may say, and certainly the evidence seems to suggest that they were talking out of two sides of their mouth. But I think it's often possible in a big bureaucracy, and when you're eager on the objective of winning the war, to promising left and right. And it's very possible that the left hand didn't know what the right hand had done. But actually you had a situation where the Arabs had been promised independence and where the Jews had promised this. Well, I don't think that Jewish immigration would have spurted forward except for another event. Sometimes when you see these things happen in your history, you ask yourself, where is the hand of God in this? One of the interesting studies is to read history with the observation, where is God's hand back of what is happening? If Hitler hadn't driven his pogrom against the Jews to the point that about 5 to 6 million Jews were gassed, there probably would have not been quite the eagerness to go back to the land of their fathers. There are very few American Jews in Palestine, but the American Jews have supported it with gusto, but they're satisfied being here. But after what happened during World War I, with so many Jews actually slaughtered, I remember talking with one of the men that was sort of my guide in the government while I was over there, and he knew I represented the church. He said one day, he says, I don't believe in churches. I don't believe in religion. He says, my wife was a very pious woman, he said, but even she questions now, for she lost her parents, she lost her brothers and sisters, she lost practically all of her relatives in the gas chambers. Well, you can easily see why people would want to get away from a part of the world where to be called a Jew was to be made the butt of criticism and judgment. And now, of course, the Zionist organization really went into high gear about getting people to emigrate back to Jerusalem or back to Palestine. And the immigration swelled. And as the immigration swelled, and even though property was bought, the peasants who had tilled that property were then pushed off that property. And they, of course, became very discontent. You have protests, mass protests, something like we've had with race issues, in the 20s and on into the 30s, about 7, which involved bloodshed and fighting, the kind of street fighting. And one of these occurred, and there were about 70 people killed in 1936 when we were over there. So it had been building up toward a crescendo. And Britain was saying she entered into an agreement with the Arabs, with the Arabs, that promised no more immigrants until we reviewed the case. She announced this to the Jews. But even though the Jews accepted the quota, when that quota had been exceeded, she would bootleg people in. Boatloads of immigrants, and the boats would anchor outside of the 3-mile line, and they would sneak them in under cover of darkness. And so it swelled tremendously. There isn't time to go through in any detail all the things that took place in this period. But finally, Britain felt like someone who could no longer keep house, or like a schoolmaster who finally says that he can't cope with these children. And Great Britain notified the League of Nations that they would be surrendering the mandate. This put the League of Nations to work, of course, about investigating, and they'd had many committees before that. And they came back and recommended, this was in the spring of 1948, that an area wherein most of the Jews had settled should be set aside as a land for them. Roughly speaking, this would take from north of Haifa down the coastline, then jogging inland at one point, and then down to almost the Egyptian border, but not much above the coastland, except for a strip up toward Jerusalem, with the understanding that Jerusalem was to become an international enclave, that is, an international city, in which everyone would have some representation in the governing of that. As part preparation to deal with some of these things as they would come up in discussion, I went over to the United Nations one day when I noticed the agenda indicated that they were going to discuss the internationalization of Jerusalem. And the day I was there, Dr. Charles Malik, not Jacob Malik, Jacob Malik was the Russian, Charles Malik, the Lebanese representative on the United Nations, or in the United Nations, and he had also been a president of the United Nations. He got up to speak to the issue, and I have never heard a layman make such a remarkable Christian testimony right there on the floor of the United Nations. Charles Malik taught philosophy at Harvard University. That gives you, at one time, gives you a little bit of understanding of the type of man and his great gifts. He reviewed history. Then he said, gentlemen, he talked like a schoolmaster, now and then shaking his finger. Gentlemen, I submit in every issue that comes before this body, there are political presuppositions that must be taken into account. But he said, in this instance, it's not only political presuppositions. You must also take into account religious presuppositions. For he said, this is the land where our Lord walked and taught and healed mankind, where he died for the sins of the world, and where he rose, and then his hand shot up like that, on the third day, victorious. Right across from him, they sat in the kind of a large circle. This was the Security Council. Sat Romico and Jacob Malik. And I could see them talking back and forth and tittering. But this didn't in any way keep back Charles Malik. And alongside of him, Mr. Eban, who then was Israel's representative to the United Nations, sat there. He listened very quietly to everything that he had said. Now, when Israel saw that it was likely that Jerusalem might be internationalized, what did she do? She moved her headquarters from Tel Aviv up to Jerusalem, sort of squatter's rights. And even to this day, practically all of the nations have their foreign embassies back in Tel Aviv. Even the United Nations has, the United States has, thereby witnessing to the fact that that had not been approved by the United Nations, but Israel is seated there with her headquarters, and if you want to talk with anyone in government, you go up to Jerusalem. Now this indicates the kind of a thumbing their nose at the United Nations in some of its decisions. Well, at the moment that the United Nations reported that they recommended that this area where the Jews had settled should be set aside as land for the Jews, then immediately the Jews had their declaration of independence. That wasn't on the 4th of July, as ours was. It was on December 14th in 1948. And the moment that they declared independence, the United States, through President Truman, recognized their independence. So here you have one of the great powers of the world at once recognizing, and then followed a number of others, and Russia as well. So here they were then, it had been recommended by the United Nations, they had themselves declared independence, several nations, and one after another followed, had acknowledged this. Then the Arabs became bitter, and it seemed to them as though the promises that had been given them went glimmering. And there was a Arab legion, so-called, in Transjordan that had been trained by the British Army, and it was perhaps the best equipped militarily group. They surrounded Jerusalem. But somehow or other, the Jews defeated them, or at least scattered them. Mr. Cadman told me one day when we were drinking tea during a break in where we'd reached a stalemate in our discussions. Then he said, during that period, we had only one anti-tank gun, and we had only one man who knew how to operate it, and he was in the hospital with a wounded arm. And we saw the column of the Arab legions coming down from the north, tanks, armored trucks, and we hurriedly told this man in the hospital that he had to train somebody how to handle the one anti-tank gun that they had. He said, I can't do that in such a short time, and he got up out of his bed, and he said he would handle it. He might have to handle it less dexterously. And he aimed well, and the first, I don't know whether it was an armored truck or a tank, he shot and he destroyed it. And this was a little bit like what happened in Gideon's case. The Arabs, not knowing how much they had, and seeing one of their tanks or trucks demolished, turned and left. Well, during this time, many of the people, the Arab people, seeing what happened, became very much afraid, because the Jews had trained something of an army also. And as they began to march in, then many of these people, out of fear, left the properties on which they had lived. And in some instances, the Jewish army had, the Jews may tell you, but some of our workers that were over there knew of it firsthand. They had bayoneted innocent people in some instances and had frightened them terrifically, and they fled. And that created this large group of refugees, numbering eventually around 900,000. Fear will drive many people away. And then those who weren't afraid, they had a few places where they made an example of this. In other words, Israel thus got more land than what had been promised by the United Nations. No peace was declared, but an armistice was established. This was in the first of the wars, you might say. This was in the summer of 48. And it was then that Count Volker Bernadotte, who was the Jewish representative for the United Nations seeking to mediate peace, was shot and killed. It's generally assumed that it was a gang of Jews, the so-called Stern Gang. And then it was that Ralph Bunche, a black man, the assistant to Count Volker Bernadotte, carried on the negotiations, and they did that over in Cyprus. And in February of 1949, an armistice was declared, but no peace treaty, an armistice. Now during this entire period then that followed, well into the 50s, you had an uneasy situation. The Arabs, fearful of what more might be done by the Jews, and the Jews eager to consolidate their gains. And whether the Jews admitted, you can find in their works that many Jewish men of letters would write about that someday we are going to have all the land that was there when King Solomon ruled. Now, this was not said officially by government representatives, but it was said by so many people, and you can find it in writings. And the Arabs got that, and they became fearful that there was no possibility for them ever to have peace with the Jews. And again, they felt, this is our place, and just because Hitler acted the way in which he did, why don't you give him room in the United States? Why do they have to come here? This is the kind of language the Arabs will use towards you. About this time, in October of 1956, Nasser is then head of Egypt. They began to think it's time that the Suez Canal should no longer be in the hands of an international corporation, where it was the West that controlled it. Just like people in Panama are beginning to talk about our Panama Canal. And there are some aspects there that bear investigation. And Nasser seized the Panama Canal. Everybody was saying, they won't be able, these Arabs won't be able to run that canal. But they took it over and they began running it right away. At that time, Israel, evidently having conferred with France and with Great Britain, attacked. And the ostensible objective was to seize the canal from Nasser away from the Egyptians and return it to the hands of the corporate owners of the West. Then the United States spoke out. Eisenhower was then president and said, this cannot be done. The day for seizing things through military channels is over. And of course, we were the power at that time. Russia was not as strong then as she is now. And when the United States said that, then they carefully withdrew. But out of this period, Israel had had a good part of the Sinai, but they hadn't been able to get over as far as the Gulf of Aqaba. The Red Sea, when it comes towards the west, there's one arm that is extended through the Suez Canal to the Mediterranean. There's another arm that goes off to the northeast, a deep gulf that reaches into the land not too far away from the Dead Sea. And at the head of that, there is a seaport, and the Jews got a hold of that, so seaport Eloth, and that's right near where Solomon's copper mines were, and they started to work those mines again. So they then had access to the world with their goods to the east. After this, Nasser, having taken the canal, or he having retained the canal through the intervention of the United States and the withdrawal of France and Great Britain and Israel, he began to be perhaps a little bit cocky. My friends who worked among the Arabs a great deal tell me that we shouldn't have paid any attention to all the bold words the Nasser spoke, because that's their way. But you've got to use words according to the meaning that the dictionary gives them. And Nasser threatened, and he actually told the United Nations armed force that was there on watch to see that all sides observed the armistice agreement. He told them to get out, and he told the General Secretary of the United Nations to withdraw them. And he seized some heights that overlooked Eilat at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba, where he could have aimed the cannon right down on that. With this kind of blustering on the part of Nasser, and the threats to move in farther, and actually sometimes in his threats he said, we are going to destroy Israel. So he seemed to be giving healing to the words of some who had written, said, we must take this whole area. Then Israel, feeling that they could not allow this to keep on growing until suddenly they would be struck, Israel took the initiative, and in June 5, 1967, they attacked, and they were well prepared for it. And they had done their intelligence work well. And while Nasser had emplacements of guns near the Gulf of Aqaba and some other places, and the United Nations force was gone, yet he wasn't really prepared for it. And they had all of their airplanes that had been given them by Russia like sitting ducks on fields in Egypt. And almost overnight, the Israeli Air Force destroyed all those planes. That was known, you know, as the Six-Day War. And they came on down to the Suez Canal and swept that whole area. Immediately, the United Nations set to work to try to obtain an armistice. And Britain, Russia, and the U.S. all behind that. Israel had to back down. And this they did. They smarted over the fact that many things were in their hands, and yet they had to back down. On the other hand, the Egyptians smarted because they had been so thoroughly whipped. And this gave them a feeling of, people say, well, the Arabs can't do anything. So quietly then, over a period of a few years, Russia replaced all the planes that had been destroyed and much of other war material, and added to it some of their most sophisticated weapons, some anti-tank guns that were extremely effective and that could knock a tank out of commission without much difficulty. And then what became known as the Yom Kippur War, a few years later, broke out. This was a festival like our Easter or Christmas, and they expected maybe that some of the soldiers would be on furlough, and they felt this would be the time. And Egypt had quietly entered in with agreement that Syria would hit at the same time. And when the Yom Kippur War broke out, they had thought that the Suez Canal would have held them back, and the Israeli had a kind of a Maginot Line alongside of the Suez Canal. But the Egyptians swept across the canal and swept into the Midianite Desert, and as Israel attacked with her guns, one tank after another was demolished by the accuracy and the effective weapons. And I think one could say that Israel would have been destroyed by the Egyptians at that time, except for one thing. They appealed to the United States. But there wasn't time to get the war material over. The Israeli would have been demolished before that. So the U.S. took weapons, not from the United States, but from all of the weapons depots that they had in Germany and other places, and then flew this in immediately. And when the Jewish army was really re-equipped over almost, well within 48 hours, and then they attacked. And I suppose that the Arabs weren't quite prepared for that. And this time then the Israeli army swept up on the Golan Heights, down to the Jordan River, and right on across the canal, And there is no question but what they could have taken Cairo at that time, and it would have been a terrific victory. But once again, the nations of the world said no. And an armistice was declared. And the Jews, the Israeli army, backed off on the other side of the Suez Canal. Now, what about the present situation as it is now? The United Nations, in declaring this armistice and getting those who were involved to withdraw, said there must now be an effort to bring about peace, and suggested that there be a meeting in Geneva with representatives of the Arabs and representatives of Israel to discuss peace issues. Israel refused to go to Geneva, probably because she felt the world was stacked against her. You have read in the newspapers about all of the discussion about reading Israel out of the United Nations, and the United States having announced, then we will use our veto. The United States hasn't used their veto more than one or two times. Russia has used it a number of times. Well, they know then that Israel could not be kicked out of the United Nations. In this kind of situation where there was refusal to talk to each other, then Kissinger, whom I think has showed more evidence of really understanding the heart of the problem, the deep-seated feelings on the part of the people. Let me illustrate how deeply seated these feelings are. At one point in our ministry to the refugees, we said to our representatives over there, this is kind of folly, constantly feeding and supplementing what the United Nations gives them, and not trying to help to get the people resettled somewhere so they can start over again. And so we proposed to our representative then, Dr. Edwin Mall, that we should have a pilot scheme to try it out at least. And we'd gotten permission from the government of Transjordan that they would identify certain land portions, and then we would provide tools and opportunity for people to begin to have something of their own. And if that worked out, then probably more, and then certainly the United Nations would have gotten into it. And Ed Mall said to me, Fred, he says, they'll never consent to that. Oh, I said, Ed, you've been here so long that you're just, you've been immersed in their thinking. Ought we not at least to try? Well, he said, let me have you introduced to the problem. So one evening he got together 13 leaders among the Arabs, the mayor of Jerusalem, some of the city council, several men from the parliament at Amman, and one man from what was called the Mixed Armistice Commission. This was a commission with half Jews and half Arabs that would investigate every time there was some violations of the border. Among these, all were Mohammedans but one. I presented what we proposed to do, to try to help to heal the wounds there. When I got through, all hell broke loose. I have never sat in any meeting where I could literally feel the hatred so thick that you could almost cut it with a knife. And the Christian was no different than the Arab Mohammedans. I think one man, who was a big fellow, physically, in other ways too, who talked more than the others and seemed to express their sentiment. At one point in his tirade, he marched up and down in front of where I was sitting, and he would shake his finger at me each time he passed. He said, why don't you go home and make your own people free? He said, you aren't free, he said. And that finger came very close to my nose as he would wave it back and forth and repeat this. Now, what did he mean by that? He meant that the United States is controlled by the Jews. Now, while we laugh at it, let's not say that it isn't without some element of truth. Now, not real control, but if you speak publicly, I know one of our pastors out in California during one of these episodes wrote something to try to hold forth the Arab side. And the editor called him down and just, well, said never again would he have a right to use his columns if he would write that way. And one government man, U.S. government man, some years ago admitted to me that the strongest, one of the strongest lobbies in Jerusalem is the Jewish lobby. They're very skillful about having someone else say some things for them. They're very quick about recruiting others to say things. What was it? There was something that happened this spring when I think Senator Jackson made some statement. Well, I can't say that this actually happened, but I would not be a bit surprised because the news story added this statement that the Jewish lobby supported what Jackson had said. And I wouldn't be surprised with what they prepared the copy for. So they know something about this. They are spending more time lobbying in this country now, especially since they've gotten some oil money to send people over. Now, in this kind of situation, where the feelings are so sensitive on both sides, you've got to deal very, very carefully. And you, if you can go one foot forward, you go a foot, even if it's only a foot. And Kissinger, as far as I can understand him, has understood this hatred of the Arab for the Jew, and the Jew's fear of the Arab and the Jew's ambitions. I don't think Kissinger, as a Jew himself, in any way countenances the program of the Zionist organization. And there are many, many Jews that do not approve of the political implication of the Zionist movement. But Kissinger has talked enough with both sides so that Egypt and Israel has come to feel they can trust his word. This is, it seems to me, the first requirement in any kind of situation. And now, of course, what they have gotten, Israel refused, you remember, in March to accept some of the things. And then many of them say, well, you're exerting pressure on us. But they forget, perhaps, that they are exerting pressure on us in order to get assistance. And if they didn't get assistance from the United States, they would be left flat. But he has used this very skillfully as he has talked of both sides and talked of the future and objectives of peace, until he got them to sign for withdrawing to a new line, not all the way back by any means, but withdrawing. So they gave up the Mitla passes, where it is tremendously important from the standpoint of defending themselves against another attack from Egypt, and gave up oil fields which they had taken away from Egypt. And in turn, they have gotten some modest concessions from Egypt, that Egypt will no longer officially speak evil of Israel. And I think the great gain that has occurred in these last years is this, that no longer does Egypt and Syria and Jordan speak about that Israel must be destroyed. In fact, if you happen to tune in, one evening I came home and I was listening to 10 o'clock newscast, and lo and behold, here they had King Hussein's address, a commencement address he gave. It was either the last days of May or the early part of June at the Citadel in North Carolina. And he addressed himself to this problem. And he said, we, and I'm sure he wouldn't have dared to say we unless he had consulted with Assad of Syria and with the President Sadat of Egypt. He said, we no longer demand that Israel shall be destroyed. She too has a right to a place in the world.
But we require that she withdraw to those borders that have been outlined by the United Nations. Now, the Palestinian Liberation Organization does not say that. And Iraq does not say that. And Libya, yes, Libya does not say that. But Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt, and they are the ones that are immediately involved. And when they say that, then it seems to me, although there's nothing there in reality, already there has been a tremendous change in the points of view. And that's why it seems to me, now that we are closer to the beginning of a solution, we must by all means support Kissinger in what he places before the United States. Well, there are many Christians who say God has promised to restore his people to the land of their fathers. And there's no denying that you can find in Scripture something of that kind. But what does it actually mean? He promised that he would bring them back from Babylon. And he did, but it was only a remnant. It wasn't the entire group. And in what way does God restore them? This people have great contributions to make. And they could render great influence. My position is this. If God intends to do some things that are different than what one sees, he'll take care of that. For me, I can't see more than beyond a few feet, as it were. And it seems to me that if we are children of our Heavenly Father, we are obligated in all situations to deal righteously with people, no matter whom they may be, as righteously over against the Arab as over against the Jew. We must go to each in the name of our Lord and let God take care of whatever he may have in mind, and he may bring blessings out of it. Now, this agreement that Kissinger is placing before the Congress will last only 3 years, so we have 3 years in which to be continuing to work at it, so that there may be Syria will be persuaded, and maybe Israel will be persuaded to yield some things up there. So these next 3 years are years of grace.